The internet is often a hostile environment for women. With harassment, revenge porn, and even threats of death or rape, a number of women have come forward recently with harrowing stories about what they've encountered online and with little recourse.
Our next guest studies online hate and what, if anything, the legal system can do about it. Danielle Citron is a professor of law at the University of Maryland. Her book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, is due out later this year. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So how hostile an environment is the internet for women, would you say?
You know, I guess it depends on who one asks. But from, you know, I think a female perspective, it can be a really hostile place. And, you know, the empirical evidence tends to show that online harassment is a pretty pervasive problem. There are about 850,000 cases of stalking that are largely, you know, occurred by using network technologies. And in the study of online harassment, there's a consistent set of statistics that over 75% of the victims are female. And what I've found in my work is that it's not just that it's the identity of the victims who are targeted, but it's the message that's sent. When individuals are targeted online, it's often in a very gendered and sexualized manner that's very demeaning. So the threats are often threats of sexual violence. The defamation often says, you know, people, there are lies spread about women, and it's often that they have sexually transmitted infections. They're prostitutes. So that the abuse isn't just that, it isn't just that the victims, their identities are more often female, though men can, of course, face online harassment, but that the message that's sent and the way in which we go about it is demeaning and shameful, and often reduces people to their kind of diseased sexual parts and is very sexually threatening.
Can you give us a couple of examples? Because this has happened, and there have been some high-profile instances of this kind of online bullying, harassment, rape threats over the past several years. Tell us, if you would, about a couple of them.
Oh, sure. And what's interesting, too, is that I'm so grateful for the attention to the issue. You know, in 2007, and I'll give you an example, Kathy Sierra was attacked in 2007. And at the time, and I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, her experience, but at the time, there was hoopla about her case, and then it immediately died down. That is, we kind of woke up to the problem of online harassment that's very gendered and sexualized, but we sort of fell asleep. And it's not that the abuse stopped. It's continued and gotten worse. It's just, I think it's really rewarding to see the press and the media engage in this issue in a really much more sustained manner. And we see sort of lawmakers running with it at the state level to address revenge porn. So I thought I'd just note that as we started. Mm-hmm. But okay, so Kathy Sierra in 2007, she was actually a very well-known blogger who wrote about software programming. And she had a blog called Creating Passionate Users. And it was, according to Technorati, one of the top 50 most popular blogs from 2004 to 2007. And in 2007, she was attacked on her blog in the comment section, as well as receiving emails of gruesome threats of sexual violence. And I won't repeat them, but they were rape threats, threats of suffocation, very graphic descriptions of violence, both in the comment section as well as in emails she received. At the same time, she was targeted on two other blogs, group blogs, and there were pictures, doctored photographs of her put up online. In one, she looked like she was being suffocated by lingerie and screaming. And in the other, there's a picture of Kathy Sierra with sort of looking sideways and a noose beside her neck that was photoshopped in. And a commenter wrote, "The only thing Kathy Sierra is good for is her neck size." Now, she spoke up about the abuse on her blog. She was sort of set to speak at a technology conference in San Francisco, and she canceled speaking. She went to the Colorado police. They were like, "Don't leave your house, lock your doors." And she blogged about it, and she wrote about how frightened she was. And the response to her blogging about her experience was sort of a second wave of abuse. Trolls from the website 4chan went after her and sort of said, "Now that you're whining about, stop whining, Kathy Sierra," and spread her social security number, her home address, and a series of lies about her all over the web. So because she spoke up, she was sort of punished, what she says is the crime of speaking out. And she closed her blog. She hasn't blogged anywhere since. She really stopped. She was an incredibly, you know, sought-after speaker. She stopped speaking around the country. Basically, the Colorado police gave up. They claimed technical ignorance and sort of gave up. They didn't spend the resources trying to figure out who threatened her. And it had a profound impact on her life.
And that seems to be a pattern that gets repeated over and over. You get these violent threats that involve sexualization, death, rape, on and on, and in as crude a fashion as you can possibly imagine and beyond. And it seems as though the woman often withdraws, that nothing happens, nothing comes of it. Why is that?
Because it says, you know, the idea... Certainly, I think the idea behind it is silencing. It's like, you're next, watch out, watch your back. And I think not only do female bloggers who are targeted get that message, but so many other people do. I mean, I think people go underground, or they stop blogging, or they write under a pseudonym or write under a male name because they just don't want to be attacked any further. And it basically ruins Google searches of people's names. I have talked to countless victims who, after I speak to them, I'll Google search their name, and it will be pages and pages of, you know, defamatory lies, threats, their naked photos, their home address, you know, the suggestion they're interested in sex. And so, as one victim told me, she's like, I felt like she changed her name. She had to declare reputational bankruptcy because she had to disassociate herself with her online personality, because employers, friends, you know, future dates would see. So, yes, it's a story I hear time and again. It's honestly depressing. You know, in writing this book, you know, I'll get an email every other day from someone, and the story is always the same.
And part of the problem seems to be that, you know, there are women who are raising consciousness about this stuff going on. And on the other hand, you see a response a lot of the time, including from some pretty high places, that this is, you know, what amounts to frat boy pranks. And there's nothing behind it. And women just kind of need to chin up and get on with it. Other women have even suggested, you know, that women should just put the trolls in their place and move on. Just be glad that they're being harassed at all, because it means the people who are threatening them are threatened.
Right. I mean, so that response is pretty pervasive. You know, on the one hand, you often hear law enforcement, especially at the local and rural level, the response to victims is just turn your computer off. Boys will be boys. If you ignore it, it will drop down in threads. It'll go away. There's nothing we can do, and which is often not the case. But the idea is that the victims can withdraw from online life and not be hurt by it. And that's just absolutely wrong, right? That our network technologies are the key to how we live, our online identities, our offline reputations. It's one and the same.
Our guest right now is Danielle Citron. She's a law professor and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. And we're talking about harassments and threats against women online.
We're talking about anti-woman harassment and threats online.
And you can join the conversation. Have you been the subject of online threats or harassment? Has someone close to you? And do you think it should be a crime to threaten or harass people online? And if not, who is accountable? And what do you think it is about online culture that leads people to make these threats? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Danielle, one of the suggestions that has been made to some of the women who've reported these threats and suggestions of violence is that they stay offline for a while, to lay low. What do you think? Is that a viable option?
I think it's just not an option in today's world. I mean, even if you, let's say you close down your social network profile and you stop blogging, I mean, the threats and the, you know, defamatory lies and privacy invasions are still going to appear online and Googleable in your name. So even if the sacrifice, of course, to the person is to withdraw from different online tools, they can't avoid the harm. It's not something you can walk away from when other people are searching your name, and especially for employment purposes.
Well, I want to go to a caller now. We've got Dan on the line from Menominee. Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you think about online harassment?
Well, you know, there's an awful lot of ground to cover here, and I take my hat off to your guests for doing such a great job. Now, I work with kids, and I see this a lot in my classrooms, sort of the online bullying. And I see a lot of the same reactions where people say, well, you know, just don't go online and it'll leave, which is, of course, ridiculous. But I think that what this stems from is that at a very young age, kids and teenagers learn to interact in a very poor way. They learn to trash talk to each other without any adult supervision. So there is sort of an element of the fact that communication is just sort of like this. Now, that's certainly not an excuse or a reason. But I think as people age, a lot of young men view the internet and their video games and their programming as sort of their own little personal world. And when a woman makes herself known, it can often cause them, I guess you'd call it, some discomfort and sort of some spiky defensiveness. So I think that some of these people who engage in harassment probably view themselves as legitimately sort of defending their territory, which, again, is ridiculous. I don't want to use that as an excuse. So do I think this should be a crime? Well, of course, absolutely. Harassment should absolutely be a crime, but I think we have to be more cognizant of the fact that this harassment is happening points to a much, much deeper sociological problem, that we still have these deep, deep veins of sexism that, you know, in the when you're anonymous, all of a sudden can come out and, you know, shake their ugly fist.
All right. Well, thank you so much for those comments, Dan. There's a lot to think about there. Danielle, what about what Dan said about it sort of being a culture that develops for young men as they grow up online, and that they feel defensive about it, and they develop sort of their own code about defending it?
So I think, Dan, you're absolutely right that, you know, so much of this is a problem of social attitudes and culture, and that we've got to get at this at a really early age. That is, to teach all students that we've got to treat each other with respect, not kind of a one-time, you know, you have sort of cyber harassment or bullying training, but an ongoing conversation in schools, when incidents happen, to talk about it, not to be defensive and say it's not doesn't belong to our school, it's not a conversation we have, and to have parents be as involved as they can be. You know, so often parents just sort of wipe their hands of their kids' technology use and say, I'm outpaced by the technology, I'm not going to get involved. And they really have to be. And that's not to say that as involved as a parent is, that nothing will happen to their kids online, because that's not true. I mean, it is absolutely the case that really none of us can protect ourselves from it, no matter what we do. If someone decides to target us or cyberbomb goes after us. You know, but when you asked the question, Veronica, like with Dan's insight about kind of boys seeing the internet or internet spaces as their own, and there's, you know, studies from MIT about the culture of gaming and online games that finds that there is this like deeply rooted misogynistic and homophobic and racist sort of gaming culture that is often kind of part of the bravado of gaming. And it can be overwhelming, and it drives people away from gaming. And that, I think, in part, it goes back to the thought that we need parents more involved. This is never going to be cured overnight. It's a conversation we've long been having. We had, as regards to domestic violence, sexual harassment in the workplace, we once thought both of those was private family matter, we don't get involved. And sexual harassment in the workplace was, just personal relationships gone sour or a private perk of the workplace. And we, over time, saw them as social problems. And I think it's the same sort of cycle again. We have to see online harassment as a social problem, not as no big deal or frat boy nonsense, but a real serious problem. And I think it's going to take a whole lot of different, but it's really complex, as Dan was underscoring, and it's going to take a whole lot of sources of attack of how we change our social norms online.
We're talking right now with Danielle Citron, a law professor at the University of Maryland, about anti-woman harassment and threats online. And we're wondering what you think about this. Have you encountered this? If you're a woman, have you ever felt threatened or like you were not being respected online? And what do you think should happen when there is harassment online of anyone? Who should be responsible? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-324-8834. And Danielle, I want to ask you about, you know, a counterexample right now. You know, we have seen in the past a couple of incidences of rapes that did occur, and there were, I guess, the sentiment among certain people that the authorities who were investigating the crimes were not responding properly. And so what happened was online communities formed together and they revealed in some cases who they thought to be the rapist. What about that sort of solution to the problem where you have people sort of coming to the defense of somebody else?
Right. So, you know, the Steubenville case, you're right, is such a perfect example of anonymous hackers kind of getting involved and putting the pressure on police officers in Pennsylvania to do something about it rather than kind of circling around the perpetrators, right, in a kind of code of silence. And what's interesting in the sad note is that the hacker who revealed the name of the, I guess, four football players who were involved in the young woman's rape has been charged with and indicted for computer hacking crimes. And so, you know, in some sense, it's the lesson of we shouldn't violate the law to help it vindicate it in other circumstances. And some of the problem is, and I think I'm more troubled by the kind of cyber mob effect that, you know, if a cyber mob goes after someone and then supporters go after the mobbers, it's kind of like a one-way ratchet to degradation. You know, it's like everyone is threatened and harassed, and it's just devolves into destruction. So I think, you know, it's often that in some respects we want, you know, victims to speak out against abuse, to feel like they can have a voice and respond. But, you know, sometimes naming and shaming attackers leads to much worse of a blowback on victims than we might imagine.
So what is the right thing to do for anyone, a man or woman who is harassed, threatened, getting death threats on the Internet? What should they do?
Right. I mean, I think the first response is to go to law enforcement. Terroristic threats of violence that are graphic and strike sort of immediate fear in someone's mind, is a crime. It's a crime under state and federal law. Cyber stalking and cyber harassment often fall under criminal statutes for stalking and harassment. These laws aren't perfect. They often require sort of direct communications with victims. But you've got to go to law enforcement. And I'm not suggesting that there will be a terrific response. I mean, so much of my book is the story of we've got to change our social attitudes so law enforcement gets it right, so they, you know, investigate complaints rather than just turn people away. But we can't give up on law enforcement. The more law is enforced, the more, you know, perpetrators will, or future perpetrators will get the message that this is serious. They have something to lose. It stays on your record forever. We, you know, we have legal tools. We have to use them. And I'm not saying law can do it all. It can do a little bit, but it should be, you know, victims often underreport both rape and other kinds of gendered violence, including online harassment. Victims underreport it, and they should go to law enforcement. As depressing as it might be, if they're turned away, they have to try. And so that's, I think, the first response. The second response is there may be civil claims that can be filed. And, of course, lawsuits are expensive. And if, let's say, someone doesn't have the resources, I mean, there are actors on the web, you know, and as you introduced the program, you were talking about, like, Internet intermediaries and what role that they play. Sites like Facebook are really virtuous. To the extent that there is harassment on Facebook, they have a team, four offices of a safety team, you know, with hundreds of individuals working on and taking very seriously online harassment. So sometimes there is nothing you can do because the site operator you ask to take down the destructive lies and privacy invasions, they laugh. They're immune from liability, and they can say, too bad, so sad. We're not doing anything about it. But there are some, you know, really terrific online players like Facebook who will.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Danielle Citron. She's a law professor at the University of Maryland and the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace.